Jill Meredith Wolf is my name, and today I am 36 years old. Today is August 18th, 2016, and we're in Chicago, Illinois, and I'm with my friend, colleague, and fellow advocate, Kathy.
Hi, my name is Kathy Kane Willis. I'm 47 years old. Today is August 18th, 2016. We are at the StoryCorps in the Chicago Cultural Center, and I'm here with Jill, who is my friend, colleague, and partner in advocacy.
Kathy, thanks so much for taking time out and being here with me. I've been fortunate enough to know you for a couple of years now, and I'm hoping, though, that you can take me back to a time where I didn't know you, where from what I want to hear from you is really understanding that you're an advocate at heart. That's one thing I know about you. But I'm hoping you can sort of tell me about your early days of advocacy and how you started and what you remember, what sticks out.
So my early days of advocacy was at a time when the HIV, the AIDS crisis was full blown. And I was pretty young. I'm, 47 now. So in 1990, 1991, I was pretty young. I was 21 years old, maybe 22. And ACT UP was in its sort of kind of last days. But when I started going to ACT UP meetings and when I got involved in this, it came from the perspective of being a former injection drug user. And I knew so many people. I lived in San Francisco. I lived in New York. I went to college in New York and then in San Francisco. So many people who had AIDS, not even HIV, but AIDS. And I knew so many people who were injecting drugs. And I really wanted to make a space for people who injected drugs to be able to do that safely without getting HIV and to start a needle exchange in Chicago. And I actually sent away, I loved doing advocacy. There was a time when Cook County Hospital, that's what it was called at that time, was going to shut down the AIDS wing, for women and children, right? Like, because gay men, maybe not so much at this time period. It was a very different time. I put together a banner. I painted it with paint. Like, we went to the Cook County board hearing and got thrown out. And I remember unfurling the banner. And I really, really, really so much wanted to make a difference in helping that cause and helping the people that I represented. But I was young, and it was hard to sort of push on that, even though I did send away for the materials on how to start a syringe exchange. Mm. But I was really early in my recovery. I was young. And then ACT UP kind of, it started getting politically involved in like the Iraq War. And then the people with AIDS were sort of like, we're dying here. We can't be sidelined by these other issues. And so that kind of just fell by the wayside. And the movement sort of fell apart or changed in a way that was very fundamental. But I have to say that when I sat in those spaces in the Uptown Bank and at the age that I was, being heterosexual, bisexual, however you want to dice that particular carrot. I don't know why I said carrot. But, that I was not, I didn't know that where my place was. Was I welcome? Was I in the right place? But I really wanted to do something that mattered, that made a difference for people like me and other people.
Could you describe, you talk about at that point when you were advocating and really getting involved, you were in your own sobriety. Did you, when you were actively using, how could you describe for us sort of that spark inside you for advocacy? Because
I still had actually a spark for advocacy, even though, I always wanted to change things. And I remember when I was first arrested, one of the things that happened to me was, like, I wanted to not overthrow the jail, but kind of. I was sort of like, well, hey, you people, come on, let's rise up against the man. And, what happened was someone, like, picked me up off of my bunk Somebody had given me $20 saying, like, you need money in jail. Here's $20. And I was like, why do you need money in jail? Well, now I do know why. And, like, just picked me up and, like, here, little thing, I'm going to pick you up and take your money. And what are you talking about, you people? This is a system. Like, I did not understand that. But all of parts of the reasons why I got arrested, which are not, we don't need to talk about here, was about building a different world, a better world, about really trying to take down at that time what I, you know, believe was a capitalist, a system that didn't work for people. And I thought that what I was doing would help. And to some degree, the drug use and just my own personal history just made that very complicated. So even in active addiction, I mean, people talk about active addiction as like, oh, you change people, like you're a totally different person. I was not, mm-hmm. you know, Jill. I still read 2 books a week. I was still the same person. I just was addicted to drugs.
Mm-hmm. So when we think about your young self,
yeah,
either before or after you were using.
Yeah.
What did you envision your future self to look like?
Yeah, so I didn't really think of a future self. I kind of assumed when I went in for treatment, the treatment that did not work for me, they said, you know, we should do an HIV test at that time. And I said, well, I might actually, there's a possibility that I could have HIV because I have shared needles. I lived in San Francisco and, you know, whatever. I had risk factors. And they were like, we don't want to test you because if we do and you come up positive, your insurance will drop you.
Mm.
So I knew my boyfriend had been tested and that was mainly who I shared with, but I didn't know really. So I just kind of assumed, and during that advocacy work, I always wondered, am I HIV positive? I don't know. But I was so terrified to get tested. I just kind of assumed that I would, you know, die pretty, like, young. I just assumed that something, that I was going to die of AIDS. That's really what I thought. I thought, you know, well, that's, I don't know, or something. I don't know why. I didn't think about that very much at all. And I never took the test until I got pregnant.
Hmm.
And it was the reason why I did the test was because I would not have had a child if I had HIV. At that time, you know, things were different. There wasn't, you know, the kind of treatment there is now. But the idea of me inflicting what I had done to myself onto another person was something that I couldn't live with. Hmm. So that's why I eventually did it. I didn't do it for myself. I did it for this potential person who didn't exist yet.
And was that fear still as strong when you did get that test finally?
I mean, there was a fear. Like, I had compartmentalized it and, like, really locked it away in a very tight cabinet. And I remember my husband saying, what, you never had the HIV test? And I was like, listen, you mother something, you were in a coma in 1983, 84, before there was an HIV test, and you had a ton of blood transfusions. I'm sorry, mister, have you had an HIV test? Now, you know, that probably wasn't the appropriate response, but we both got the test, and it was all fine. But I think the reason why I got angry was because there is a stigma associated with it, and I felt it when he said that. I don't think he meant that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was like, how could you have walked around for all these years? But in order to keep walking around, I couldn't dwell.
You compartmentalized.
I compartmentalized, and I couldn't think about it. I couldn't think that it was or wasn't. I just had to, like, leave it in another separate place. Because if I thought about it too much, it was too depressing and too sad. There was no cure. There was nothing. There was no, not that there's a cure now, there was not really effective treatment. There wasn't, I didn't want to live with that knowledge. And then I wanted to just kind of live my life.
And so there's not a cure for HIV yet. And there is a cure though for hepatitis C.
Right.
Right. And hepatitis C is a place that also has a shared stigma and was really part and parcel to what was going on in the ACT UP days but nobody knew about it at that point.
That's right.
Tell me about sort of your experience with being a substance, being engaged with substance users, either peers or professionals, whatever it might look like, and living with a stigmatized virus.
Well, you know, I know when I first publicly told my story to the Tribune, they took that part out about the hepatitis C part. And that was in 2009, so that was 7 years ago. And I have to say that having hepatitis C, and I know HIV activists might disagree with me, at that time might have been more stigmatized in a certain kind of way because it was clearly from injection drug use. Whereas, you know, with the gay rights movement, there's been a lot more understanding of that. And then, like, heterosexual transmission, sexual transmission. You know, sex is something that people do. Injecting drugs is, like, looked upon in a very, very, very negative way. So I would say that I carried that stigma with me quite a bit. In terms of being a female, you know, when you have periods, like, there... At that, when I found out, and I didn't find out that I had hepatitis C until I was 32 years old, even though I contracted it when I was 19, and my daughter was 2 years old, you know, at that time, there were no booklets on, like, what do you do with a tampon? You know, they said, don't share toothbrushes or razor blades. Well, I'd been married for a long time. I'd had a child. I mean, the thing that freaked me out the most, beyond my impending mortality, which was quite scary, was the fact that I felt like a contagion. I felt like I was hepatitis C, like I could infect you, even though I knew that I couldn't. But, like, it's so easy, like, you know, to cut yourself. And you work in an office and, you know, my fear around cutting myself or cooking or getting blood in something, not about me hurting myself, but about, again, hurting someone else with my blood. I think that's a very deep thing, you know, that, like, what runs through you and keeps you alive is something that is contaminated and could lead to someone else's early demise if you shared a toothbrush or a razor blade. And imagine having to explain to your, you know, very young child, never use mommy's toothbrush. Like, what do you do? I mean, you don't want to, like, freak them out so much. Never use mommy's razor blade. Never. Like, again, when she went, you know, started shaving her legs when she went through puberty, like, be clear. Never, ever, ever, ever. I will buy you, you know, 20 million, and I mean, still we have like 20 million razors in our house, because I didn't want her just in that moment of like, oh no, I don't have a razor blade. I'll just, oh, mommy said not to, but you know, I will just use it. That worry, that fear, that's still real to me. Yeah. That is still so real to me. And when I cut myself now, it's like, I don't feel this, like, I do still sometimes react. I'll see blood on my hand and I'm like, oh my God, I've got to go wash it off. I have to bandage it, make sure that I'm not bleeding so that I don't, you know, because hepatitis C actually lives for a long time.
Yeah.
It's not like HIV, which is a very weak virus. And so, you know, that was really very, very difficult to deal with. And I think it's still, the hepatitis C isn't inside of me, but you know what? Still that feeling that I might contaminate someone is still something that I'm getting over.
Wow. You really described that so beautifully. I'm curious. You talked a bit about compartmentalization as a tool that and sometimes really helps and in other times hinders. And you're good at compartmentalization to be able to kind of put your head down and move through and be an activist or do what you need to do. Tell me a little bit about how you compartmentalized, knowing, because you're a smart chick, like, you knew that you had something maybe before you got diagnosed, before there was a test, for reasons of fear and whatnot, or doctors' ignorance and all these various reasons that you went, what, 12 years living with this before they found it?
Yeah, let me think about it. That seems of night 11, maybe. How did I think about it?
I'm curious, like, so you found out at an early age, and knowing that there was this impending doom of, like, your liver's getting sicker, like, how did you compartmentalize that kind of thing?
You know what? This is the thing that when I found out at age 32. No, was I 30? I was just 30. Yeah, I was only 30 years old when I found out. And, you know, a doctor told me that I could be dead by the time I was 40.
Mm. When you were 30, you were told that.
Yeah, my daughter was only 2 years old. And I think what it did was it made me realize that life is so short. And for me, it was so short, right? And that my desire to do things, to get things done, to make the world a little less unfair, to fix things, to be an advocate for people who use drugs, to fix the criminal justice system, to deal with all these systemic issues that no one in 10 years could deal with. I think it made me work incredibly, incredibly, incredibly hard to do that, because I did not know how much time I had, and that I would spend most of my time doing this because I didn't have very much time.
And I mean, I just want to say, worked so hard and so well that today you sit as the director in an extremely influential role here in Illinois, making impact daily on Illinois citizens and people across the country too, because I see you on panels and whatnot. I mean, have you compartmentalized that?
I think the thing that I've learned now, and I think this is part of advocate self-care, but it's also a part of a result of, you know, curing the hepatitis C, is that things don't have to be so fast. You know, yes, change needs to come quickly, but let's just say I don't need to wear myself to the core in order to accomplish. I have time to do what it is that I need to do, and then I can also relax. I can also just savor and enjoy my life, that it doesn't have to be so directed only towards a goal. That many people called me, like, a workaholic, but maybe they didn't understand, you know, what it is to think that you only have a decade. And and maybe for most people that would be spending as much time with their loved ones. But for me, it was really trying to create this advocacy, this space, this doing something, changing things so that other people didn't have to deal, that their experience would be maybe better than mine in terms of what they had gone through as people who use drugs or people who currently use drugs. So I think that I didn't realize how much I felt I needed to accomplish. And, you know, I mentioned before, like, did I need to make tapes for my daughter? Did I need to make videotapes in case I passed? What were the words of wisdom I was going to pass on? I mean, all of this at the same time, you know, all at the same time.
And so, you know, we've talked about compartmentalization. We've talked about that as a young person, you didn't really have this understanding of a future self. And we can almost think about this in like 10-year increments, if you will, that you were told you'd only have 10 years to live. Well, your liver is like smiling at you today. And that 10-year cloud has been removed. What does that mean for you now? Do you still look at 10-year increments as...
Yeah, no, I don't. And I mean, you know, from the time that really, it was 16 years from the time that I was diagnosed before the time that I decided to seek treatment, you know? So...
It's a long time thinking a certain way and having an understanding.
I mean, it becomes sort of part of who you are. So I think in a certain way, it's like a lizard shedding its skin. How do you redefine who you are in the space of not having... you know, a possibility of something like that hanging over your head. At the same time, though, I would not trade my experience for anything, because I do think that people assume that their life is going to go on forever, that they don't realize the randomness of things, that they could get hit by a bus. So it was both useful and hurtful at the same time to be given these, you know, 10-year increments of living. But it's kind of nice to think about, you know, going bird watching and playing Scrabble with my husband and maybe retiring, like actually like not working until I die, you know, and being defined sometimes outside of advocacy as being defined outside of this, just working and working and trying to change the world and just enjoying and savoring. I think that's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
It's very hard to move into that place. And I wonder how many people, you know, I moderated this group on Facebook. How many people, they were so happy, you know, to be cured, but how many people felt a loss of like having this thing that defined them for so long and all of a sudden it's no longer there? Is there a loss there?
Mm.
You know, is that a thing too, especially if you've seen yourself as a patient? And I think a lot of people did or do, you know, they had a very different experience than me.
Yeah.
They were treated and retreated and retreated and retreated and retreated. And, you know, that's partly why I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to take on the patient role or the sick role or the addict role.
Mm.
I'd rather take on the badass role. That's what I wrote down on that sheet. But no, I
tell me about that. What is the badass role? Define it for me.
You know, the badass role is like, I'm not going to let, you know, all of these things define me. I define me. I define how I'm going to do this. And you know what? I'm not going to fall into the stereotypes of this is what a former heroin user, an injection drug user, a junkie looks like. You know, I'm not going to, this is what a mom looks like. No, this is what, you know, this is what an academic looks like. You know, this is what, yeah. And this is what, and like, this is what an aging body looks like. This is what I look like. This is who I am. This is not, you don't define me. I define me. That's what badassery is about not letting people define that, and not letting doctors define that for you, not letting your loved ones define that for you, you know, not letting society define that for you. And there are some things that are inescapable. People will define that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, race can be, you know, you can't, gender can be one of those things too. But in terms of these labels that we attach, that we create, that have seemingly so much significance, I refuse to, because I think while compartmentalizing has its pluses and minuses, labeling can be very, very destructive to people.
Yeah. And you know, with that, I guess I'm asking you this question as the professional that you are, as the person that you are, as the mother, as the wife, as the advocate. You know, we talked earlier about you not having an understanding of a future self, and today that's very different. And in terms of the role that you sit in, you literally said to me that everyone should have a future self. And I'm curious if you can expand on what that means, be it from a professional, a mother, a wife. What does that mean in how you live your life today?
I mean, I think everyone should be able to think beyond just today. You know, everyone should have dreams and hopes for who they will be, or fantasies or ideas of what they could do. And the idea, I mean, I feel sad for my past self, which I never thought about before, that I didn't have, that I never conceptualized a future. I just, you know, like the mile of the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. That's all I did. I kept my head down and took those steps. I thought about what I could maybe get done, but I didn't think about like any kind of who I would be, where would I be, what would I want to do. I mean, I had some notions, but I didn't have that defined idea of like, what would my future self think of what I'm doing now? Or how will I live? What will that be like? I might have always wanted to live outside the country, and I still do, but that seems like a more real thing to me. Like that I can have a conversation with my, not a conversation, but I can kind of engage with a future self. And I feel like I'm closer to that, that now my past self, my current self and my future self are more, that there is a whole me, Kathy. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe I wasn't really whole in a way without a future self. Hmm. And I think that when we deny people who use drugs, needle exchange or methadone or buprenorphine or treatment or hepatitis C treatment, when we don't allow people to have their future selves, we extinguish much more than their possibility of living. It's like we extinguish their hope, their spirits, their dreams. And those are the things, that's the sustenance that keeps people alive. That is the thing that matters, having that purpose, you know, having that. And so I guess in some way, you know, I was able to compartmentalize, right? And keep my feet down and have some sense of I'm going to move forward, but it wasn't integrated. Mm-hmm. And the injustice of the stigma related to who gets the treatment for hepatitis C and all of the tests that people have to go through. I don't mean the medical tests. I mean, did you drink an alcoholic drink? You know, the have you used drugs? You use drugs. Are you still using drugs? Do you smoke marijuana? I mean, Are you sick enough? I mean, you know, I wouldn't have passed the are you sick enough test. And then I get to that place where it's like, that's so damn unfair. I got the treatment. I wasn't sick enough. And there are people who are literally going to die. Because, I don't know, I was so lucky. And that doesn't, the world shouldn't be dependent on luck.
Right.
It should be dependent on equity and fairness. And we should have a standard. I shouldn't have gotten that treatment if you have to be sick enough, because I wasn't sick enough under that. But everyone should get it, because we should be able to eradicate hepatitis C. We could end it. And I mean, that's the thing that's so frustrating to me. So these false tests, this idea that you have to be sick enough, I mean, what costs were deferred from treating me, you know, but what are the costs that are deferred if you treat injection drug users? Mm-hmm. And they, you know, I mean, what if we can cure, end it, hepatitis C? I think we could.
We can.
I think we can too. But I think the stigma, if we did not have such a tight association between the injection drug use and this bloodborne pathogen, then I'll tell you, Jill, there would be no sick enough.
Right.
There would be no sick enough.
Right.
There would be none. And they sure as shit would not be. When you go on for cancer treatment, do they test you for illicit drugs?
No.
Before they give you your chemo? Or before they do radiation? Or before you have surgery? Hell no, they don't do that. But they do that, you know, they do that.
Before we'll cure you of the virus that's going to make you be that sick.
Right, exactly. Exactly. They do that. And I mean, they do it in ways that has no medical... Absolutely, there's no reason. It's just a way to restrict care, you know? And one of the things, and I don't know how you feel about this, but talk about badassery, is there's a group of folks who go and get the generics from India, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is not a solution that is a systemic policy solution. But you know what? For those people are just like the people with AIDS who are trying to get, except that they had the cure and they couldn't access it.
Right.
And I remember in that the group that I moderated, it was like, no, we will not have a discussion about this. And I was like, it is unfair. It is unfair that some people, whether they're in National Health Service in the UK, whether they're in Canada, whether they're on Medicaid here, whether they have private insurance here, whether they're in Australia, whether they're, you know, wherever they are, that they can't access these medicines that will cure their condition. There's so few things that we can actually cure, you know? And we're going to restrict this. We're going to restrict this. It, you know, and to say that the people who went to India and who did that, you know, that was wrong. No, that was right. that was what they needed to do. And God bless those mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, first, you know, from one advocate to another, thank you for all the work that you did with Illinois House Bill 1.
Oh.
Which, not going to reiterate, and we won't bore anyone with reiterating all of it, but it was a really important response to an epidemic in our state and in our country, which is around heroin use mm-hmm. and the heroin epidemic, which is closely linked with hepatitis C.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, you know, you spoke so beautifully about being in this place when you were young to not have much ability to look too far into the future. Mm-hmm. And then you talked about being more, you know, more middle-aged, if you will, and living with a virus and still not being able to see the future. And today, being cured, and you have a future, you see this larger future. What would you say to people who either have been living with hepatitis C for whatever, from whatever reason, mm-hmm. And then these young people right now who are in the process of becoming addicted to opiates?
Uh-huh.
Very different groups working in very similar life issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about hope and everyone needs a future self and hope. What message can you give to these individuals that really are impacted by the work that you do?
So the people with hepatitis C, I think hope is important, but maybe anger can be more useful in this situation. Maybe that was, even though I didn't have a future self, I had an angry self about, like,
so this the is, badassery self,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that this is unfair and that we need to fix things, right? And so I say to the people who are living with hepatitis C, who are not able to get treatment or who have not been able to be cured, you know what? Speak up. Scream. Make some damn noise. Get pissed off. Do not let them beat you. Beat them, you know?
Yes.
And also, don't allow your patientness to define you totally. You know what I mean?
That they are a patient themselves, you mean?
Right.
Mm. Like, to be disempowered from being an empowered patient.
Exactly, an empowered patient, or that your whole identity is wrapped up in the illness. And I know that I didn't have, you know, I wasn't sick in that way, so this is difficult for me to say, but that you are so much more than your illness.
Yeah.
You know, you are so much more than that. Tap into those pieces that you are so much more of and get mad. Stand up, speak out, you know, and let people know. Because the only way that you destigmatize something is by telling stories and by getting angry and being clear and not being embarrassed and sharing, and also not ever internalizing their feelings about you because you have this bloodborne pathogen. Do not take that on.
Mm-hmm.
You are no less. You're no better either, right? You're human. And do not let those insurance mm-hmm. companies, those doctors, the systems make you feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Fight them.
Mm-hmm.
Fight them.
Tell me what maybe you'd say to
young
people and their parents.
Parents, learn something about what is effective treatment. Young people, please, please use clean needles. Please, every single time, use a clean needle. You do not want
clean
this.
Clean everything.
Clean everything. Clean everything. Clean needles, clean
Works,
cookers,
spoons,
everything.
Cottons.
Yes. When, you know. And know that there is a way out, and that sometimes we take on labels like addict or junkie or a patient because we don't really know who we are, the young people. You know, we're looking for something, we're not sure who we are. Mm-hmm. And maybe sometimes, you know, using drugs can, it's a very quick way to establish an identity. I don't know who I am. I don't know what this world is. Well, people will name you and they'll call you a junkie. And sometimes that's a little, it's less nebulous than not being anything. But no, look inside yourself and know that you are and you will become. And that there is a way out of this. And it doesn't have to be the way that everybody tells you.
Mm-hmm.
That there are 5 million paths out of this and there is no one way to get better. And you will get better.
on this vein of messages, you know, where you sit and from conversations we've had, you've gotten really great messages from doctors and you've gotten some pretty shitty messages from doctors. You as a badass, empowered person, what messages can you tell our healthcare providers around the impact of their role on our hope and sense of identity and self? Feel free to take that anywhere you'd like.
Well, first of all, I feel like this is more for the patients, but healthcare providers, if you are pressuring, if you're coercing, and I mean this in any realm, don't do that. It doesn't help people. It puts them into a fake choice, right? And be honest with them. A lot of times you're not being honest. You're dumbing down the information, or you might not know the information. Be compassionate. If you can't be compassionate, then have someone else who fulfills that role, because what that person needs with that chronic issue is compassion and empathy.
And not to be told that they'll be dead in 10 years.
Not to be told that they'll be dead in 10 years and not to be made to feel like they're a lab rat, you know, do this so that, you know, I can have more data. You know, people don't want to be used. Don't use them. Don't use them. Be honest with them. If they don't have a level of understanding, try to direct them to places that will give them that level of understanding. But don't ever talk down to them. Mm-hmm. And don't treat them like they're stupid. Mm-hmm. And always, always remember that they are more than their disease. They are a person, and treat them like a person. And, you know, I think we like, doctors do like to sometimes scare, and it can be very mm-hmm. scary when you see those stats, right? Instill some hope. Mm-hmm. Instill some hope. And give the idea that, you know, this might not have worked now, but like medical advances are changing all the time. Look at the history of hepatitis C. That's what I would say. You know, look at where we've come in a very short period of time. If you've been treated and it didn't work for some reason, there will be a medication that will work for you in the future. So it would be hope, no coercion, no scaring the bejesus out of somebody, and empathy. That's really what we need to do.
Yeah, and think about the impact of their words. Like, you know, I think about the impact. I can only imagine, and unfortunately we don't have a ton of time to divulge too far into this, but telling a mother with a 2-year-old that you have 10 years to live, like, imagine, you know, that's a ripple effect on your family, your parenting, your sense of self, future self. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that you were cured and that you lived past 40. And I expect you to live a lot longer, too, because whether it be retirement and birdwatching and Scrabble stuff or larger advocacy, we got a lot of work to do. And you've got, you know, a pal and an advocate in me, that's for sure.
Well, thank you so much, Jill.
Yeah, this was great. I appreciate it. Last words you want to give
us? I want to say for patients, you know what? When doctors talk to you, remember, doctors are not gods. They are people too, and that's their profession. Double check. Take someone with you. Have them take notes. Really, really, really. And if your gut says, then walk out.
How about the shame piece? What can we talk about with shame?
I mean, if someone makes you feel ashamed, then you need to be in a different place. You cannot be treated. You should not be. If a doctor makes you feel ashamed about this or anything, you should leave. You should leave. And I do want patients, people with hepatitis C, to understand, please do not put your doctor in that role. And I guess this goes for any patients, people with substance use disorders. You know what? Ultimately, yes, there's expertise and there's experts, but you are the expert of yourself, you know? And there are so many different ways to do it. If you do not, never, ever put someone up on a pedestal in the way that we as Americans do with doctors, mm-hmm. I think that's a very dangerous place to be when you put your life in someone's hands that way. And don't take responsibility for the decisions and shift it to the doctor. I worry about that with people sometimes.
Absolutely. Words of wisdom. Kath Kane Willis.
Oh, the other thing.
Please.
If you do get tested for hepatitis C and you do not have life insurance, I encourage people to buy life insurance prior to being tested.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's a really simple thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not something you think about. It's like you just don't think about it. But if you're a young person and, you know, it's just something to think about. If you have family, you know, just something to think about.
Awesome. Call my insurance agent. Thanks, Kathy.